I can't come here and die. I can't come here and live. Got all this shit on my mind. Like, what the fuck am I doing? Work ain't paid me in time. My boo just ripped me my mood. O2 just cut off my line.
This is a trigger warning. This episode at times contains conversations and sensitive material that people may find difficult to listen to.
Hi guys,
and welcome to the Echo Chamber.
I'm Jade.
And I'm Ez. And today we are joined by a very special guest, Chief Mrs. Taiwo Taiwo. Would you like to say hello to the listeners?
Hello everybody.
And we're really excited to have you on today. We are talking about numerous different things, but framing it around your recent book release called My Mother's Daughter. Listeners, you're going to hear a little bit about that as we go through. Thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure.
And just to start with an opening question, so Jade, do you want to go first? How was your week?
Oh my gosh, my week was so busy. I had a press publicity day on Wednesday, so I had to sign 1,000 books. It was crazy walking in and seeing 1,000 books stacked up on the tables. I had a shoot and a few interviews as well. And yeah, it's like getting closer and closer to the release of the book. So now the interviews are starting to come out, I think as of next week or whatever. So it's like, oh my gosh, this is actually starting up now. But yeah, it's been a really busy week. I've been super duper tired. But yeah, grateful the same. What about you, Ez? How's your week?
My week has been interesting. It's been quiet with work, and that's never good because it means that I've got to do the other work of admin, personal stuff, life. So I've not had work as a distraction. I've actually had to kind of focus on myself a little bit, which has been interesting, is what I'll say. Also moved, and I've just about moved my stuff in. And it's just that the process of moving is always really stressful for me. So there's that stress. But I think it's been a quiet week. I can't really think. I did manage to go to the book launch on Thursday, which was a really wholesome evening for me. I came with a good friend of mine who's also in publishing and interested in stories and storytelling. And it was really encouraging kind of being in that space, being around people from the diaspora and having conversations about Nigeria intergenerationally. That was really encouraging. I felt really inspired and challenged.
And how about you? Well, my week, one of the exciting part of my life, I must say, is that I play so many different roles in many different initiatives. Atlantic Hall, I played a role last week, this partnership we're forming with Carleton University in Canada, very engaged, already started the first part, want to move it forward, we want to eventually establish an Afropreneur. I'm also moving forward with the Art of Life. We've been asked by the First Lady to set up 6 geographical states of Nigeria. So I've been working on that proposal, seeing how we have some fantastic partners, and I'll keep a little bit hidden someone that we hope will be, our international patron, a couple that I really admire. And then on Thursday came the book launch in London. I wrote a book called My Mother's Daughter. So the book is called Taiwo, My Mother's Daughter. We had the initial launch in Lagos. Completely out of my surprise, a very dear friend read the book and he was so blown over by it. He decided that we needed to have an international launch in London. And he organized the whole thing. And I was really, I didn't know. It was the first time that I'm doing something that I'm not in total control of. So I wasn't quite sure how it was going to pan out. But number one, it was an epiphany, to be honest, for me. I learned, that we had not engaged, and I feel very bad, my generation have not engaged the young people enough. And normally when we have something like that, because this is the third time we have had conversations around the book, we had a huge book launch on February 16th, which also marked my 70th birthday.
Wow.
And we had 700 people that joined in all over the world. We had a stage performance of a script of some of the book, and it was just a fabulous day. And then we've had it at the book club, but this was, I realized that we've never engaged the youth. And that day, I saw a different crowd because Yemi did not invite. And I keep saying to myself, why were we always inviting older people? They're part of a problem. And they do not need to become, not all of them, you know. We needed to reassure the people and we need to inspire them. And I have never been in a forum doing such a thing with your generation. Mm. And I felt sad because my son, who's 37, that's my youngest son there, he never stops complaining. Mm-hmm. Every minute, you know, the blah, 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 it's okay for you, blah, blah, blah. And I said to him, look, yeah, I can agree that when we all left university, we knew we were going to get to the top, no matter what background. Nigeria was pumping, oozing of oil. We didn't have to worry about our green passport. In fact, on the contrary, with your green passport, you entered Harrods and everybody was running after you. It meant that you have money. You were treated like rich Arabs. Now everybody's trying to get their green passports. So it's a different dynamics. And I really realized that it was not only the Nigerian youth, which is what I was trying, because I speak to him, my two boys, you know, often were close. Mm. And I said, you know, I realize that it's young people all over the world. They've been lied to by politicians. I mean, look at England. I mean, I came to England when I was 10. I was brought up here and I went back to Nigeria. I feel that this is my second home. When that decision to take on Brexit was done, I thought it was crazy. And I was shocked the amount of people that voted for it.
Can I pause you just because I feel like we're going into your story, which I think is the crux of what we want to say. So this, I really want to hear about kind of where you've started with the book and where.
Okay.
So like I said, I was at the book launch and you've mentioned a few things. So you've said Atlantic Hall, and for people listening, as a Nigerian, I know what Atlantic Hall is, but for people listening, okay, it would be really good to get just slightly more context,
okay,
for where you've got to with the book, how you got to write the book.
To go back to the beginning of my life, you know, I have always been, I think, an individual. You know, I do my own thing. I've always said, it might be crazy, but it's mine. So I have treasured the fact that I'm an individual. I started working in the family business when I was not of my own choice, but as directed by my mother, who I had tremendous love and respect for. My father died when I was 13, and she had 8 children, and he died. She was only 41. And she put together the survival of a company that was full of assets, but also full of debts. And she chose me, I'm not the eldest, I'm not the second, to take over that company. And of course, that always led to natural sibling rivalry. But she also knew me. If she gave me a role, I would put all my energy into it. Now, at the age of 28, Elephant House, let me just put you into context of it, is an 18-story office block. Each floor is 600 square meters, which in the English parlance is 6,000 square feet, 18 stories of it. All I was given was an approval to build it. And she said to me, Taiwo, you go ahead and raise the money. And I've done the hard bit. I've got the approval. So I had the gigantuous task of building an 18-story office block, raising the finance, both the short and the long term. And it was hard. It was hard. I learned a whole lot of life's work in that experience. I learned that many people pretend to know things and to understand things that they do not. I was amongst consultants, most clever consultants, and they would use words because every profession has its own jargon. And they deliberately confuse you by using words that you don't understand. And half of the people in the room would nod yes. And I would always put my hands forward and said, please, can you translate what that means? And they would. And I found that nobody else had understood it. So I've always understood that you go to school and you pay your teachers so they'll teach you. You pay your consultants so that they explain to you. Don't get bamboozled by them. Mm. And it's nothing to be ashamed of to say, please, I do not understand. Mm. So we started that project and I was so fortunate.
And so essentially, again, so for listeners that aren't familiar with Nigeria, essentially, you, at a young age, you were responsible for one of the
millions of dollars worth of project.
A project that was like essentially a high rise building in Lagos. 18 story high rise building in Lagos. At around my age, am I right in saying
20?
And so at 28, yeah, so that right. And as a woman in Lagos,
I had to raise the finance both the short term and the long term.
And when you were talking, there was something that you said. So you said, and it reminded me of a conversation that we had recently. And so when we spoke about not being afraid to ask questions. And I feel like we're at a point in our lives, in our careers as well, and where I speak for myself, where I'm entering rooms, I'm entering spaces as a woman, as a black woman, as a black diasporan woman, and being in rooms or in conversations that I could feel intimidated, or I could pretend, I could be forced to pretend to be somebody that I'm not, or I could be forced to, could be in spaces where it's like, actually, I can bluff. And I'm learning that actually having to be myself and ask questions where necessary and being authentic is the thing that usually opens doors for me. As intimidating as that might be. So it's interesting kind of one of the reasons why I really wanted to have this conversation, and we were talking a little bit before the microphones were on about the need for intergenerational discourse.
Absolutely. That is what the epiphany that I saw on Thursday. There's that gap. And so my background too was, as I said, I'm not the eldest. I was very much aware that I had to prove myself. I was very much aware that we had staff, senior management that worked in the company. You know, they used to be responsible for sending my school fees to England. So I knew humility was ingrained in me. Hard work was ingrained in me. And most of all, it was ingrained in me that I must not appear that I got this job because I'm the boss's daughter and that I had to work harder than all of them. And I don't think that's necessary what any of my other siblings are made from. That is intrinsically me. So that was I'd worked before then in Maryland Hotel. Because for the first 10 years, and that was also a great lesson, you know, running a 60-bedroom hotel is a great lesson, because hotel business is about service, it's about management, and it's about facility management and controls. So it teaches you really critical things.
I was at the launch. I've kind of had a gander at the book as well. Mm. I think there were just lots of lessons that us as younger generation African women can learn. So in terms of like what it took to operate at that level as a woman in that period in Lagos, what would you say if you were to offer us maybe one bit of advice for asserting ourselves in those in that context, what would it be?
I would say that, you know, the same as what I said. A lot of people say that it's a disadvantage to be a woman, you're picked upon. I mean, I'm not saying that it does not happen, but my experience has been that because I was so razor focused on knowing my topic. I mean, if you woke me up at the 2 a.m., I would say, each floor has 600 square meters. There's this, that, then. I knew my topic. And because I knew my topic so well, when I came to present it, you know, to any institution, any potential funder, I don't think most of the time they were listening. They were just looking at my mouth. So you need to use a bit of your guile to, but know your topic and know that, and they would know that there's nothing they can ask this woman that she won't have an answer for. So that gave them the confidence, right, to say, we want to invest in this because she has done her homework. Mm. So homework is critical. You can't get away without having that homework done. Mm. But to move further, because she did say that I have played many, many roles, and the life lessons is what I want to teach young people. The life lessons I've had, because, yes, I'm the founding chairman of Atlantic Hall, a school that has now got one of the best schools in Nigeria. You know, our students have, you know, boy, have they done us proud. Damilola Ogunbi, you know, she's the MD of renewable energy in the United Nations, all over the world. And the background was us. There were five of us. Do you want me to go through all of that? But the lesson is this. Schools had all gone down the drain. The schools that were where we, the aspirational schools, the Queen's College, the King's College, because of ethnic quota, it was degraded. The hope of our children of getting in was severely reduced. And we were moaning and groaning. And again, I said, heck, we can do something about this. Mm. You know, I always get to that moment of enough is enough. So I urge young people, when you feel so passionately about something, and I've done that, let me say, 5 times in my life, because it's not something that I enjoy to push my head into what I know it's not going to be easy. There is a formula that is tested, you know. But let me start by quoting Margaret Mead, you know. She says this, it's not whether pressure groups can change the world. The fact is, they're the only ones that ever have. It was pressure groups that stopped slave trade, that gave women the right to vote, that gave empowered the blacks in America, etc. Now, I think I want your generation to forget about politics. I mean, I am totally disillusioned by politics. And, you know, I hate it when Nigerians only abuse their own politicians. Look at the politicians there. Mm-hmm. Look at the ones in America. Mm-hmm. Look at the ones in France. I think the only honorable person that's retiring with dignity is Merkel in Germany, unless we hear otherwise. But it's all over the world. They're as bad as each other.
Can we pedal back a little bit? Sorry. So I think you've said so many things that are like, can constitute little conversations in themselves. So I think in terms of when we look at the gender stuff and being a woman, and I think that the question that sort of flagged up in my mind was when you came around the table and you knew your stuff, you had done your homework, what do you think it was that made these men listen to you and not sort of shun you or shut off when you were talking? Was there an element of privilege in that? Was it class? Did you have the privilege of your class actually was the thing that ensured that you were listened to around that table?
I'll be brutally honest. It wasn't a disadvantage that I was a boss, right? I mean, not the boss, but it was our company that owned that land. And so that kind of, they were talking, although many times there were people that said no because they did not believe I had the authority to be talking to them.
Do you think that was gender-based?
Sorry?
Do you think that that was gender-based, that opinion that you didn't have the authority? Do you think?
Oh, that really happened. I was telling you about the story of BCCI, Bank of Crooks and Criminals Incorporated that came to be known. But BCCI existed, mm-hmm. you know, and they had said yes, and then they pulled off and they made me wait from 8 o'clock in the morning. Anyway, yeah.
So what I'm taking from what you're saying is that there is there's an acknowledgement that, of course, there is elements of privilege that you did use and do use to your advantage, but essentially, without knowing your stuff, you don't think it would have gone as far.
So
I spend a lot of time in Nigeria. Jade has been to Nigeria as well in 2019 with me. So and I'm very interested in the way that I think Nigeria is a beautiful and interesting place. and I think that the role of class, the way that class looks in Nigeria is very different to the UK. So in the UK, race exists in the UK in the way that it doesn't in Nigeria. So you can be black and middle class, you can be black and very wealthy, but you're still black.
Yeah.
And one of the parts of the book launch that touched me the most, actually, and that really gripped me, was when you spoke about your experience in boarding school here.
Oh, I hated it. Like, having to say the poem, The Little Black Boy, by William Blake. That poem still exists.
Mm-hmm.
And God knows, he didn't write it. He wrote it during the time of the slavery, and in his mind he was trying to say that blacks are human too, mm-hmm. but how brutal, you know.
Even that concept of having to
explain that I'm black, but I'm as white being. As an English child,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So for those that are listening, there is a poem by William Blake called The Little Black Boy. It is a hideous poem that I don't want to even read or speak about. But it's essentially something that was shared at the book launch was your experience at boarding school.
Well,
where
I was
you were
made to say that poem at, on the Christmas play.
Yeah. And so for me, I'm always very intrigued by that. I'm going to call it that dissonance. So like in Nigeria, you have a certain level of privilege and power and wealth and affluence,
mm-hmm.
that at least opens some doors.
Yeah.
And then, like you've said, knowing your topic and working hard is what allowed you to kind of benefit from those opportunities. But then the comparison of being in the UK, and yes, even with that wealth, even with kind of coming from an affluent background, there were still those barriers in relation to race.
Oh, yeah. I mean, don't let me start on that racism topic. They're not fighting enough for their rights. They're not. Honestly, I really do. I'll be an activist if I lived here. Mm-hmm. I really would. But, sorry, you wanted to ask?
No, I mean, I think you did touch on activism before. And I think that some of the questions, so I did think a little bit about like this generation of young Nigerians in Nigeria who seem to be quite active and quite critical of the system. And I wondered maybe what you thought a little bit about their capacity to inaugurate some change in that context, if you have confidence in that generation. Because I think a lot of what you've said so far in, you know, since we've been in the studio is that you do believe that in numbers and with that spirit of activism, change can
I mean, I can give you three solid things that have changed my world forever. Atlantic Hall, before then, private secondary schools were banned. It was daunting, you know, but there are three things that you elements. Number one, you have a you're saying something that a whole lot of people agree with you. That are we going to sit here and allow our children to go to school that used to be the, you know, Eton of Nigeria, King's College and Queen's College, that's now reduced to broken windows and chairs with no legs and debased by the fact that, you know, quota system means that our children, because they come from Western or Eastern Nigeria, must get 95% and somebody from Borno State only needs 20% to get in. no, that is not right. So we created our own school. It was not something that was done in one day, but it ultimately led to the government changing that policy. And once we started it, look at how many private schools there are. So we changed our world forever.
Yeah. So essentially, in your experience, your activism has seen change. And so you feel like definitely those coming behind you, you know, our generation, the generation of some of your children who are a little bit older than myself and Ez, we do have it in us to be you active do. And inaugurate change.
I'll tell you that pressure groups, there are three elements, four elements. And I mean, I don't want to be personal, but the NSAS, because that's who I am, I'm personal. When it started, I thought, what a fantastic idea.
Mm.
You know, I didn't even know, because SARS began as a special armed robbery squad. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, 20 years ago, Lagos was infested with armed robbers. Mm-hmm. I had armed robbers in my house. The whole street had armed robbers. This is not the case now. There are quite a few reasons why it was so rampant at that time. We had a cash society.
Mm.
I mean, the women that, you know, went to the market in, you know, in Okari and sold lace and whatnot, they would have cash £100,000 to come to England. Mm. The bank teller knew they had that money. Mm. Their staff knew they had that money. So they'll target them.
Yeah.
They had cash that they could cash and take away, and they killed many of them. So we all set up, you know, our own vigilante kind of, groups. So you must not allow yourself to be involved to allow politicians to creep into your pressure group, because they will compromise you.
Mm.
You must be quite clear and quite focused. You don't try and do too many things at once. Small victories lead to bigger, applaud that victory. And so we started off, got some of our members to sweep, Union Bank was sweeping Broad Street. Then we tackled the chaos of the, and that was a big fight, you know, fighting with the transport union. They are an entrenched mafia. I'm courageous. And they came to my office and said, listen, I have the courage of a fool. I will deal with you.
Mm.
There are bus stops all on the outer marina. Use them.
Mm.
And then because we started taking pictures of the cows and the pigs and the cows every day, I'll take pictures and send it to the governor. Your downtown Lagos, cows having lunch. Downtown Lagos, pigs are roaming. Look at the fattened pigs. After 1 week, he said, what? And then I now did what? Really, there was going to be a FIFA Junior World Cup in Lagos, you know? I said, I'm going to write and send these pictures to them in Germany, in Geneva, and said, this place is a cholera risk. He said, please call these troublesome people. So that was how we started engaging government. We started making a difference, and they formed the consultative. But I told you a little bit about when we had to fight, when they started the ridiculous land use charge, we dealt with them. So you must not involve your pressure group in politics, which is what the NSAS did. They should have stuck to stay focused, NSAS. Then they started an account called Anonymous. Why should you let anonymous people put money into your account? Who are they? And then you haven't finished dealing with, the SARS, NSARS and their brutality. That's not the same topic. And then to boot, you now want, I mean, I have no problem at all. Let me re-emphasize that. It's just the point that you must stay focused. And then they said they want to, you know, deal with the salaries of the senators. I mean, who did anybody allow the senators to increase their salaries to that? They did it themselves. And the people you want to involve Lagos State, does he have any power over the senators? Of course he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So they now got themselves
Can I just say, so I found the insult, I was in Nigeria at the time of the massacre and when things really blew up. Something that we were speaking about before we were on air was that this, the world for our generation and for millennials, there's a lot of disillusionment, I think.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of, there's a skepticism. Deep, yeah, a deep distaste, distrust of society. I feel like a lot of people from my generation, particularly in Nigeria, I would say, feel let down. In as much as I really hear you about having a focused campaign and the need for a focused campaign, I also see that there is like a wider, I feel like being in Nigeria at the time, I was looking around and everything was up in flames. So it was just like people are inheriting a country that is on fire. That's where I've become really aware of my privilege. Being in that space, I was aware that actually people are not viewing me, because I've got a red passport that will take me out of this country tomorrow if I need to go. And so I had to kind of humble myself a little bit and listen to what they were saying and listen to what people on the ground had to say about that.
See, I mean, I was totally in sync with them. In fact, one of the leadership happened to be a friend of a child of my friend. I said, listen, I've done so much work in pressure groups. Let me advise them how to go about putting this together, because they're going about it the wrong way. And she said, oh, you lot are the ones that destroyed Nigeria. Oh, okay. Number one, you cannot say you're a nameless group. You don't know who's behind. That is asking for infiltrators to come in. I mean, we need to know who you need to. So they now had anonymous, and by attacking the politicians, those politicians are the most willy-nilly group. They sent out their Arab boys to. That's what I believe, because I witnessed, you know, before the governor of Lagos State sent in the army. We couldn't get out of our houses. The area boys had blocked. The gangsters, supposed to be working with them, had blocked roads, blocked entrances, were acting like gangsters. Which country would allow you to do that? And how did they even get mixed up with your fight? I've been in London once, actually. It was several years ago when I saw a riot go out of hand. I can't remember. Oh, boy. I remember Theresa May was the Home Affairs.
So it was probably 2011.
Sorry?
The 2011 riots that started in Tottenham.
I mean, we watched it go out of hand.
Yeah.
And people started looting Argos. And
everywhere.
Everywhere.
Lidl, Pax,
and you know, I thought, Direct. I thought, oh, this can happen in England too. And I thought, how weak of me. Of Theresa May, because she said, parents, call your children in. And she said, she doesn't know that as they're leaving the house, daddy said, I will pick the radio. You pick. I mean, and you know, the people living in the West End, they were still ambivalent until they saw the first stone hit their restaurant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in our neighborhood, it was everywhere. And, you know, anarchy is not something that you want to introduce to anything.
Yeah, I find a lot of what you've said interesting, because I think what I got from maybe your take on activism is you can see the fruit of the methodical sort of, like a really methodical and strategic approach to activism and really knowing where you're going to hit the jugular, you know?
Yeah.
And then you're sort of comparing it to like where there's a groundswell of grievance and there are a lot of different issues. So you did cite, you know, I mean, we've got to be honest here. There is NSARS, and that is an issue. And then there is, you know, the persecution of queer people in Nigeria, which is also an issue. And there's so many things. And I think what is so pertinent to me is the how much difference class makes. And I think with certain comforts and luxuries and things that I need to protect and look after, i.e. my home, my land, my cars, I have to be methodical and strategic in my emotion.
Yeah.
When I haven't got much to lose, I don't give a hell. Do you know what I mean? I don't care.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just think a lot of this conversation, we're kind of drawing it back to like, is it the class privilege that sort of changes things, no, you
let,
know?
Let me give you an example.
And sort of, and sorry, just sort of gives us a difference of perspective, maybe.
I don't think so.
Okay.
You know, let me tell you why. It's still the same, you know, playbook. You must get a critical mass of people that believe in what you believe in, right? Get an articulator, which is what we did in Limji. Limji was huge. Mm. Do your study, right? Have a short-term, medium-term, long-term goal, right? And go about doing it methodically. You can't change a city. I mean, in one day. Now, you include people who are as passionate as you are. You need that critical mass. But you do not want to create anarchy, because anarchy will actually damage your name, will ensure that when you call people again, they say, those thugs. Mm. I mean, those girls, they lost over ₦1 billion. And they're people that started off believing in that in stars. So you cannot, and they cannot call anything. They ruin their name. Now, what I never understood is that my understanding was that at a certain point, the governor called them up and said, let's talk and see how we can deal with this.
Okay.
They didn't show up. They said, oh, government, I mean, why would you do that? You can go to government and bang your, which is what we did with Limji. When, after we wrote a letter saying that if this continues, we're writing to FIFA and we show them the pictures and they won't come. They called me in. And we came in there and we said, when we invested this kind of money into the central district, we never knew that your intention was to turn it into a gangland.
Mm.
Now, since we cannot remove our millions of dollars of building and plonk it in New York, give us back our money. Mm. I mean, you can. And they knew we were deadly serious. But a conversation starts. So we continue that conversation. But they ended up doing exactly what we wanted. The greatest compliment is government copying what you said. After it's meant to be their job. They did exactly what we wanted.
Mm.
And, you know, when they challenged us, like, oh, you guys are always complaining. This was after the land use charge. We said, okay, you want us to build a fire station. Show us that you're worth your metal. We talked to Shell. Shell happened to have his headquarters next door to Ajene Fire Station. Do you know that we built with $2 million raised by Shell, given to us by Shell, an ultra-modern fire station equipped with the most modern gadgets you can imagine? We brought the chief of fire of New York to train 100 firemen in the skills, and we donated it to the city.
And I think that you
and what a tremendous feeling. I have to say, I haven't been back for a few years. It might have turned it into something else. I mean, but it was a tremendous feeling of government, private sector intervening and showing government what can be done. So that's what I wanted to tell them, that listen, just don't take everybody into your group. Be clear what your end game is.
Mm.
And I mean, you can't, I remember, let me give you an example. Somebody came at a certain point and their building was in Balogun. They had a high rise in Balogun. Balogun is the headquarters of selling. All the markets are there. And they said they wanted, and Limji was predominantly Broad Street and Marina, where you must have a common and, you know, brand and common interests. You cannot say that you're fighting to keep a place, a commercial center, you know, and that's probably what went wrong with Vera, Victoria Island and Ikoyi Resident Association, because they turned that area into commercial, into residential, into everything. In fact, they started taking each other to court. And that collapsed. But we stopped to that very limited brief. So when this young man came to see me and said, oh, the company would like to join Limchi because I should just come and see what, I mean, they have empty buildings, they're surrounded by, you know, midstellars. And I said, listen, unfortunately, you have plunked your building right in the middle of the market. What you can do is turn it into a modern market. I mean, it's accepted. You know, I mean, you can't, I mean, turn it into a modern market where, you know, and charge them right, you know, but it's no longer, it's no longer viable for serious office. Mm. So that's what I advised him. And I had to say, no, I'm sorry, I understand. You know, but we can't, you can't be a member of Limchi. Mm. So that is what I'm saying.
I wonder how some of your strategies would apply today, and if there are different variables that have called on a different version of activism, maybe. Some people think that anarchy is necessary for change.
Oh, please, I beg of you, don't talk about anarchy. Oh, don't romanticize the unthinkable. Look, let me tell you, I mean, don't even romanticize it. If you've read about the French Revolution, if you've read about the Russian Revolution, if you've read about any revolution,
civil rights,
it levels everybody. And it kills, in fact, as somebody, a good friend of mine, he said, when the revolution comes, just start looting your neighbor's property. Because forget your own house and join them in the loot. It is undesirable. Let me also remind you, because I'm also a good student of philosophy. The whole reason, you know, why man, according to Aristotle and Plato and all the great philosophical thinker, why did man decide to give up his intrinsic liberty, right, and hand it over to a central authority? Because man, in the state of nature, right, they could do exactly what they want. If you see something, you can grab it and eat it. If you see, yeah, man was as bestial as animal.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a destructive man. And it didn't have longevity.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, I'm quoting the reasoning of the wise philosophers, right? So man decided to give up his intrinsic human rights to a central government. But that's why we must remind government what they're there for three reasons. To ensure that we should be able to go to sleep at night and not expected to be killed. So security. Number two, we should expect to be able, right, to make our own, to be able to earn a way of keeping our body and soul together, right? And number three, I think, I can't forget, they had a responsibility to keep us healthy.
Mm.
So those three matters, we have a right to demand of government, right? That we keep them on the we remind them, have you, our safety. So anybody that's advocating anarchy is actually going against the very principle of why government exists.
I very much agree with a lot of the political philosophers and this idea of like the tacit consent that we give over to central government to govern us and, you know, sort of steer us away from a state of nature. I do in theory agree with that. But I think when we do look at governance and when we think about Nigeria, even when we think about Britain contemporarily, there is an element of a state of nature, a sort of every man for themselves that exists among our government and the people that govern us.
That is when we can call them to order.
Yeah, and so I think that anarchy being a reaction to that is very natural Because there is rage and there is that lacking sense of security because of the actions and the behaviours of government.
I wanted to touch on, because I think one of as you've spoken about in the book, you've spoken about the tragic loss of your daughter in a car accident. Okay. And you spoke about your activism around that. So what you in response to that tragic event, you put up a traffic light at that place. So it was a road traffic incident, and then also lobbied the government to take traffic to put traffic lights up in other parts of the city, which I think is as a response. And then from that place, sorry, you also have developed working with grief counselling, which is something that in the Nigerian context, it never did happen,
you know.
Could you tell us just a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bree, my daughter, she was the very best of me. You know, she was stunningly beautiful, she was clever, she was humble, she was killed in a car accident 2 minutes from our house. I happened to have been away in Egypt. You know, she saw me off at the airport, and 5 days later this happened. And, you know, honestly, my first instinct is that I would never open my eyes again. I thought, how can she be somewhere ahead of me? I'm meant to be the one that is showing her. I took her to university. I took her to secondary school. How will I show her the way here? I was so enraged with God. And that was an emotion that nobody tells you about. My daughter was such a powerful force. I would see her tap me, wake me up, say, "Mommy, you know, I wanted to phone Shauna, who was the person that came to take her out, and, you know, she's feeling so bad. Call her and tell her you're not angry." I said, "Bree, I'm not a saint." And, you know, she said, "Promise, and then I will fall asleep and I'll call her." So, in a way, I had an unusual experience. And, I mean, her friends, young people tend to be the best grief counselor. They didn't come to say stupid things like, "Oh, it's a work of the devil." Or, you know, they came to just hold my hand. Mm. You know, our friends came from England, from all over the world, just sat on my lap and just, you know. And, I mean, some of my friends said, "Look, Ty was an activist. If she can come out of this, she will change her world." And I promised her. I went to the mortuary and I promised her, and I just said, "Everybody leave me," you know, and I put on the tape that she used to listen to every morning because she was into yoga, and I felt her spirit and I saw to her that nobody will ever forget you, Bree. And I think I've done that, you know. You know, it was a long journey of pain, but it happened in April 19, 2002, and I couldn't breathe until I'd put up that traffic light. I told the government I was going to do it. They gave me the permission. And on December 3rd, which was her birthday, I had it commissioned. And I told them I was going to put up traffic lights in every junction. That's what I said to you. You can shame government. They said, "No, don't. You will. You can shame government to do the right thing." Because how does it look that a woman lost her child because of your madness of not having, how are people meant to see at night? And what kept grating me was the amount of people that kept saying, "Oh, X was died on this spot." But, I mean, what are we doing about it? And people don't even know that is how come we have traffic lights all over Lagos. That is an example of what I'm saying, that you can change your world forever. Not by anarchy, but by shaming government. Mm. So they have, and people don't even remember it. People don't remember that, you know, there was a time that we didn't have traffic lights. Mm. You know, again, I have found with Atlantic Hall, we were able to change our world and create an environment that other private schools, you know, in so many times people come to me, oh, come and set up a limji in my neighborhood. I said, you idiot, why should I come to your neighborhood? You guys get yourself together. I can give you, you know, how we did it, but it was the hardest job I've ever done in my life, you know. But people are willing to sit down and complain and moan, right? My son that moans and groans. I mean, he took my cue. He lives in the Korean. It was the neighborhood. It was just, but he formed a neighborhood watch, and they are doing the right thing. I think, and I honestly believe this, it's not only Nigeria. You know, you have two things to do with bad government, right? Unfortunately, our third estate, the media, is so corrupt all over the world. I mean, look, just this morning I was talking to a friend just before coming here. She said that she lives in New York, that in New York, the whole of all their newspaper are blasting with the impact of Harry and Meghan's visit. Mm-hmm. And the awe in which they're held. And then they looked to the British newspaper and it was as if they'd created an alternative universe. They are determined to see anything bad about it. Mm. But none of you black people are talking about it because it's racism. Mm.
I think that we are definitely.
I don't think they are. I mean, I am. Mm. I am. Mm. I mean, I've gone and I like this morning I've done three. Mm-hmm. One idiotic person that said they paid for people, and I said, maybe you watch, and it was empty. I said, maybe you watch, you know, an alternative vision for what I saw. I saw them being applauded, celebrated, and in the most tumultuous thing I've ever seen from any. And you're telling me that nobody was there? I said, you know, because of your hate of them, doesn't mean that other people, and you, you know, you lot in the royal family, you're disgracing yourself because you're letting us see what the royal family stands for. Mm. Look at Zara. She sold her wedding photographs for £500,000, for £500,000 to Hello. Her brother, he did a milk interview. Did you see that? Mm. In China for £500,000. That as for Charles, he just paid £1.5 million to give somebody a knighthood and a citizenship. Mm-hmm. I mean, don't let me start with Andrew. They made him ambassador for business in England. As I said, it was like giving an armed robber the vote. That's exactly how I wrote it. And I said, you are opening up a Pandora's box and letting people into the goings-ons of the Windsor, and you're playing a dangerous game. And I really do believe that. So, but this girl, I mean, she's a very smart lawyer. She said, you should have seen the whole of New York stand still. You want to keep on the narrative that they're dumb. Do you think that Procter & Gamble would do business with them? They're the hardcore business people. You think all the people that are involved in doing it, they're idiots? You know, so what I'm saying is that I don't believe in fighting with the government physically because you cannot. But I believe in, speaking truth to power. Mm-hmm. And I also believe in the fact that by showing them up, mm-hmm. you know, do you know that by us setting up Atlantic Hall, all the standards of the government school, King's College, has improved. Mm-hmm. They're now incredibly good schools. So by standing up and showing them what is the right thing, you know, nobody had ever heard of grief counseling. But I knew that the way that I was treated by kind people, they made my grief worse. I mean, who wants to be told that, oh, no, you mustn't go to the funeral? I said, if you don't get out of my sight, I will punch you. You know, and my family knew that. Or they just treated me as if, and some of them stood away from me. I said, look, this is not an infectious disease. And then they'll be coming to my house and say, ah, Taiwo, she's gone. Oh, she's just talking to herself with a picture of her. And they said it to my hearing, because I lost my daughter, didn't say I got deaf. Mm. I've always had a sense of humor. I said, I'm not deaf. I can hear you. So I knew that I had to teach them about how to handle grief. When I came over to England within 6 weeks. I went to grief counseling. I saw the so-called best here. I didn't find them helpful because we were all scientific and, you know, the fellow was saying all negatives. Are you angry with your daughter? Are you angry? It's not a science. And I went to Compassionate Friends and I learned that even here they're not. The Samaritans are good. Mm-hmm. But they're not for good, but they just confront them and they let you talk, you know. So I came back and first thing I did was to set up the foundation. I wrote the mission, everything up myself. I put the traffic lights up. Then I went to Professor Lambo and I said, I want to set up grief counseling. I mean, he was a doyen. He was the first psychiatrist in Nigeria, in Africa. I happened to be an uncle of mine. Everybody wanted to do anything to just make Taiwo's pain less. He didn't know I was that serious. By the next day, I'd written the minutes of the meeting. And so we set it up, and we did. And we started by letting people know how we felt. And we set up our own model, which was a four-step approach. And, you know, it included theory, practical, clinical. So we actually had experiences of going to a clinical session with a psychologist, with patients, and understanding how you open up, how you use certain keywords to get people to open up their emotions. And then we had what we call a town hall meeting. And then we certified. And you know what? A week after we finished it, Dr. Lambo died. And so we were on hand to counsel his family. Mm. They were in deep grief.
Feels really full circle, and a kind of beautiful expression of ways that you can kind of use hardship to create change. And I think that, that's the tale throughout the book. Just to for people that are listening, where can they find the book if they want to buy it?
It's on Amazon. I have a very good person in Nigeria that just helped me because I got it registered. But Amazon is, you know.
So we'll have it.
It's been tested. I mean, you get it within 24 hours.
Brilliant. We'll make sure that we put a link for that in the description. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on. We're really grateful to have had the conversation. For me, I think it's really important that we're able to sit down and have intergenerational conversations and maybe disagree a little bit and maybe negotiate and get to a place that we're comfortable. But yeah, for those listening, please go out and buy the book.
And I just wondered if I can say a lot. I empathize with you. You know, don't give up. Force, look, I quote Mahatma Gandhi. You can be the change you want in your world. Mm-hmm. Don't wait for him or her. You can be the change you want in your world. Be the change. Don't look for politicians. They are all compromised. All of them, all over the world. Mm-hmm. Because the whole system of how you become a politician is a compromised system. You can be and be that change in anything that you're passionate about. You know, form a group of people and be sincere and be willing to be tenacious, but you can be the change the world you want in this world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming on. And guys, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, guys. Cost me my lunch. My lunch money. I can't come here and die. 98 on my feet. 20 more on my mind. Can't be nibbling on bread. And see me, I do what I like. I see it, want it and eat it. Gee, I can't be begging what's mine. Fuck, I can't be begging what's mine. I'll pay that shit when I want.